Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the tables?
Today, we are sitting down with two amazing creators from the award-winning actual play, Transplanar. Connie Chong is the game master and creative director of Transplanar, as well as the game designer behind the duet Holy Punk TTRPG, God Killer. And C. Thomas is an actual play performer, producer, and especially important for this conversation, the dramaturge for Transplanar. Connie and C, welcome to the table.
Welcome.
Hey,
thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, thanks for coming.
It's great to be here.
We're really excited for this conversation. So good to have you on.
I feel like this one has been like a long time coming. And now that Arc 4 is happening, it feels like a great time to like jump in and get your guys' thoughts on actual play and dramaturgy and the arc of what you guys have done at Transplanar over the past five years?
Five years.
Oh, yeah.
5 years. It's wild. It's been
our
half
toddler.
A decade.
Wow.
Our literal child.
It's when you start putting things in that kind of time frame that it's like, ooh, oof.
More than a degree. Could
you can't
be a toddler.
Stop time,
yep. This past June, the anniversary kind of hit us in the face like a brick where I was like, oh, wow.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Whoa.
The brick at Stonewall came for us. It smacked us in the face.
So 5 years, the two of you have spent 5 years in this creative partnership, among many other titles that you have at Transplanar, of GM and dramaturge. And we want to dig in on this relationship, this role of dramaturge, how it plays into how you think about AP, how it connects to your AP ethos at large, and then connect that to this latest arc of Chaos Protocol. But, you know, first, we want to, for any of the uninitiated who are listening, what is Transplanar?
All right, Connie, hit it.
Yes.
The spiel.
I've got the spiel all locked and loaded. Transplanar RPG is an all transgender, people of color led, dark fantasy actual play channel telling stories set in an original non-colonial anti-orientalist multiverse. As we mentioned earlier in this chat, we've been doing this since June of 2020. So over 5 years at this point. We started with a homebrew D&D 5e kind of campaign that as that went on, the more we did it, the less interested in D&D we became. And we haven't played that game on our channel for years now at this point. After that wrapped, The Second Stranger, which was how everything began, we produced God Killer First Blood. This kind of coincided with when I released the Ashcan of God Killer. And then we've moved on to the Chaos Protocol, which is our current main campaign. Each arc of the Chaos Protocol follows the same three main characters, the same three core PCs, but across a different plane of existence. So we use a different game system for each arc, as well as we feature a different artist for the character art. And we get to kind of play in different genres, a different tone, grapple with different themes, but there's like an overarching campaign spanning mystery and set of core themes that act as like a grounding through line, dramaturgically speaking, for the entirety of the Chaos Protocol. And as of this recording, we've just embarked on the premiere of Arc 4, and we have 8 arcs planned. So this marks kind of our entry into the midpoint of the campaign, which is a really big deal for us.
It's wild to look at something that is already so big and expansive as Transplanar and be like, oh, you guys are at the halfway point.
Just getting started.
Yeah. Long-term and long-form storytelling is really our bread and butter. We've done some miniseries and one-shots, of course, and we really enjoy producing those things, but kind of the heart of our show has always been in like the really long, long boil.
Yeah.
It's the thing we feel like we're missing from our creative expression is we want to get into long form. We do so much short form but we love long form as like consumers. So yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, we just gotta find enough time between all of our short form to do a long form.
Yeah.
Yep. That's the hard part of it.
It's the hardest part. I'm curious, especially when you guys are looking at such a longer timeline of like 8 arcs of having this massive thing planned. I'm curious what were your artistic goals for the show when you started? And then how have they evolved over the past 5 years and over the first 3 and the start of this 4th arc of the Chaos Protocol?
So our goal, I would say, for everything we make, long form or short form, one shot, mini series, main campaign, is always to tell a really great story. That's kind of our guiding principle, first and foremost. And then to tell a really great story well. both in terms of like the artistic and creative process that goes into it, but also in how we treat our cast, how we treat ourselves, how we treat everyone else involved in the production. And it's really important to us that everyone is on the same page creatively, that everyone is aligned with like a core vision of what the story is all about. I mentioned earlier kind of the tentpole guiding themes of chaos that kind of act as a through line for all of the arcs. That was something that C and I came up with from the very beginning of the Chaos Protocol. We had a general sense of the premise. We knew we wanted to be like, we knew we wanted to use different systems across each arc. And we wanted it to kind of be like an AU sort of situation where like, you know, you'd have the Fursona season and then you have the vampire season and then you have the sci-fi space pilot season, right? That was like the sellable premise, right, for the series. But the heart of the series was always about the three core themes of grief, vengeance, and revolution. And those are like the underlying core principles of the narrative that we built our cast around that. So we chose our cast based on people we knew could really execute on those themes and would be really interested in untangling those themes, you know, over the course of months and even years at this point.
I mean, the timeline between the start of The Second Stranger and the start of Chaos Protocol is really radically different, where we kind of walked backwards into the actual play space with Second Stranger, where we really kind of didn't really know what we were doing, but we had ideas, hopes, dreams, and a really poorly made overlay to go with it. And we just kind of went for it. And we kind of learned as we went. And then being able to take that very long, very beautiful, very resonant experience and then finesse it, look at what worked, what didn't work, what could make that beautifully strong story even more beautiful, even more strong, and apply all of that to how we ran production for Chaos and how we're running production for Chaos. So multiple session zeros, a really, really thorough like pre-production process for the show. And like Connie said, being really clear about what our themes are, what elements that we're telling through the story, casting for that, speaking clearly and plainly about that. But also I think one of the fun, important things is not just making themes, but making a thesis statement about your themes that everyone in the cast is on board with. So not only do we have our themes, grief, vengeance, and revolution, but we also have thesis statements, what we are trying to say about those themes through the story. And I think generally speaking, Transplanar and the Chaos Protocol in particular takes a very artistic forward approach to actual play, more so than an improvisational friends at the table style way of doing actual play. I love both, but for me, what really sings and what really resonates and what I'm really interested in pursuing is a artistic craft medium of telling a story through actual play. And in that way, we get into interesting pieces of craft and how to build narrative thoughtfully, intentionally, with design and with improvisation in mind. And I think Connie and I are both primed in interesting ways to tackle this as people who are, I won't speak for you, Connie, but for me coming at this from, I am a dance history and performance major. That's what I studied in undergrad. I also had an art history minor. I walked on stilts a lot. I did a lot of very, very weird experimental physical theater and have always thought about and made art in a visceral and physical way and used improvisation in my dance and theater works. So being able to bring those elements into actual play to be like, okay, how do we not script, but choreograph our way through this story? We know where we want to go across the stage and we don't know exactly how we get there, what exactly the moves or the steps are, but we know that we're going in a certain direction. We want a certain staging. We want to say something. We have themes and we have thesis statements about those themes. So how do we execute them? And how my role as the dramaturg is to make sure that all of the performers, Connie included, are able to tell their story as best they can in the strongest terms that they can. So my role is really as a support beam for the story that everyone wants to tell together to make that an easy, interesting, fulfilling process.
I love this sentence that you just said of, we're not scripting, we're choreographing. I feel like that is like the thing that's going to stick in my head for throughout this conversation. It feels like the real encapsulation of this role of dramaturge, which I think is like we're naturally transitioning into talking about a bit more. And I think, you know, to bring like what we do into the conversation. I think there's this interesting thing where at My First Dungeon, we use producers, you know, on all of our seasons, and our producers support the GM. And I think with this role of dramaturge, y'all take it a step further. Like y'all take it a step further into the guidance and these themes and the thesis statement. So I would love to dig in a bit just more on this dramaturge role, because I'm fascinated by it and I want to understand it. So you talked a little bit about what you do, but at a top level, could you just tell us a bit more about what a dramaturge does when it comes to AP and when it comes to a transplaner?
Yes, I can. This is my favorite topic. I'm so excited to talk about it because I
could see you jumping up and down the whole time getting ready for it. It was really great.
It's like we're getting into the good shit. So I firmly believe that a lot of people who are interested in doing actual play as art form and as storytelling and as narrative are already doing dramaturgy and don't know it. So let me first preface this by saying that I think all of you are doing dramaturgy and you just don't know it yet. welcome. So my role as the dramaturg is essentially to be the support network and the voice of the overall story and overall narrative. This is distinctly different from what I think the story and the narrative should be. My role as the dramaturg is to support the vision of the players and the GM, ostensibly, and all of us, the story that we're trying to tell. So it's my job to keep our themes, our values as a channel as well, in my mind, and the desires of each cast member, their particular story arc, their character arc, what they want to say through the character they're embodying, and Connie's overarching goals of what you want to stay with this story. And what I do basically in week to week is I'll meet with Connie where we'll talk about our goals kind of for the next episode / the next few episodes, where we'll say, okay, we're starting arc 4. Here are the things that we kind of need to do to set up this arc. Here are the like thematic foundations that we're laying. Okay, where do we want them to go in this episode? Connie will bring a lot of like GM world building, prep, lore, narrative, plot to me. And then I get to take all of that information and then go to the players and be like, okay, so we've already finessed, we already are thinking about what you want your personal character arc to be for this arc for. Like, we know you want to like have this moment of betrayal. We want to have this moment here. Okay, so how do we start that process? How do we lay the groundwork for that? And it's all keeping in mind, like, okay, this person wants to tell a story about monstrosity. This person wants to tell a story about denial. This person wants to tell a story about coming back to a home that you have lost that's really different now. So it's kind of, I feel very much like a weaver, where I am weaving in everyone's intentions to be aligned with the story that we're trying to tell as a whole. Because there are a million different mini stories happening inside of each character in each moment, in each world that we go to, and braiding them all towards something that is not just narratively satisfying, but also narratively impactful for the audience as well. Something that is legible, something that can be braided together to be also received well by the audience in the way that it is intended by the performer.
Yeah, if I can jump in quickly here and also mention from my perspective as the GM, I really see C as like the crucial connective tissue of the channel, where they bind me and the players together, because they're like the player liaison, essentially. Like, they take my notes, they filter it through their dramaturg lens, and then they present stuff to the players like, hey, so Connie has some stuff planned for, like, for instance, like a travel moment. Right. So like some things that might be useful for you to think of as a player is like, what might your character be doing on this travel? Right. And think of all the things we're trying to accomplish for this arc and the things you're trying to accomplish for your own character. They'll have that dramaturgy meeting. And then C will bring all those notes from the players, filter them through like a GM facing perspective, and then come back to me and be like, here's what all the players want. And here are some ideas that came up for me, knowing what I know about your prep and the player's desires. So they're both like the connective tissue, and they're kind of like almost like a think tank. Like they come up with like cool ideas, right? And ideas for the direction.
I'm the brainstorm.
Of the story. You're the storm full of brains. And one word that really has been percolating for me through everything you've been saying, C, is cohesion. Because I think For me, one of the big challenges of, for instance, a home game is cohesion, because you have, what, 4, 5, 6 different players at the table and the GM. And, it can be fun, especially if you're playing kind of like beer and pretzels game, right? But it can also be, especially if you're the kind of person that likes having a strong story, it can be a little frustrating or difficult when it's like 6 different people doing 6 different things. They might be interested in each other's stories, but they're exploring radically different ideas. And they might have radically different approaches to solving a problem, which is fine. I think that's totally fine. And that's where a lot of the fun of a tabletop role-playing game comes in. But when it comes to what C mentioned earlier, our approach to actual play, Transplaner's specific brand of storytelling, we like for things to be a bit more cohesive. We like for every important thing that happens in the show to matter in some way. Like, that's why I don't really do random encounters, right? No matter the system. That's why I don't just kind of have like, we don't just have random scenes that happen that kind of go nowhere, right? It's important for us that every scene serves a purpose, whether it's to reveal character, deepen the lore, push the story forward, or ideally all three in some way.
It's an interesting thing I'm imagining where like there's this version of what you're doing, see, that is kind of like, I could see somebody being like, well, everybody could just say everything about their character that they want to do. We could just be like, let's put it all on the table and talk about it. But I feel like then you're playing a GM-less game, which is a very valid, cool way of playing, and like, you know, having just like that. But like you said, the artistic approach means that you have to craft the amount of information both sides have a little bit. Does that feel true to you? Like there is a limiting of information between those sides in a fun artistic way?
Yeah, sometimes. I think there's definitely a finesse that comes with it too, of like, especially because it is a long form game. So the idea that like we could just kind of go for it means that sometimes like if folks just went for it, one of the funnier things that happens in Chaos Arc 1, two characters have wanted to do a romantic slow burn. And by Arc 1, Episode 5, I sat them down as the dramaturg and I was like, you need to go slower. You are burning this slow burn so fast. I love you both. I know what you're doing. You are having so much fun together. But if you want to have this narratively satisfying slow burn, which in pre-production, you told me that's what you wanted. So I'm here to be the person who tells you that this is moving a little too fast. So let's pour a cold bucket of water on this fast burning fire and let's slow it down. You know, so there is some level of like negotiation that happens too, of like, okay, we want to have this big character thing moment happen. But what I love about long form is that the longer you set something up, the more impactful the payoff actually is. So in order to have like a huge character moment that feels narratively satisfying, you need time to set it up and to set it up well and to set it up thoughtfully and to hit all of these little tiny beats before you get to that big moment. Because it's not just that big moment. It is the framework around that big moment that makes it impactful and makes it really narratively satisfying. And I think there is a lot of work that I do to, on I think both ends, like both with Connie and with the players, to find that pacing in a lot of ways, kind of the long-term pacing of how the arc goes, how personal arcs go, and how plot arcs go as well.
I'm also seeing this kind of as like translation, in that there is the direct translation of a thing, that of translating one word to another or one point of view to another, but also like translating intention and translating intention with the nuances of what the GM is thinking about and what the players are thinking about, that you may be saying the exact same thing, but the words to use them, the messages you have to convey to each side will be wildly different based on what information is needed from each.
It also really resonates with how each dramaturgy meeting with every cast member, even outside of Transplaner, other dramaturgy that I've worked on for different shows, every style of even like weekly meeting that I have with every person, even on the same show, is radically different. And how people interface with doing dramaturgy with me. Sometimes it's like a thoughtful bullet point of like, here are the questions that I have, C. Like, what do you think about this? Okay, here we go. Sometimes I am just screaming and throwing knives at the player back and forth. We're just like, oh my God, what if it was like this? Ah! And that's how it goes. And both are really generative and really fun. And then they get funneled into how I talk with Connie and then how I go back to the players and how I do their session overview and so on and so forth. It's really fun.
This does really remind me of when I was working in television as an assistant director. Like, you'd go to the different department heads and you had to speak to them in different ways because there were certain things they didn't care about. There were certain things they did. There were certain ways they wanted to be talked to or information they wanted at a certain speed and time. Mm-hmm. And in the process of learning each of those individual pieces of communication, that's how the entire machine went faster and faster. It's a slow is smooth, smooth is fast kind of thing.
Mm. Yes.
And then you make a movie.
Yeah. And then you make a movie. Scenes
and then you make something cool. Yeah.
And then you make an actual play.
See, what you're saying really resonates with my experience in narrative design, actually, in video games, is this very interdisciplinary approach to making a really cool thing. Because, see, you not only interface as the dramaturg and producer with me and the players, you're also like our main liaison with the artists we work with. And a lot of the contractors we work with too. So C knows how to speak to artists from like an artist perspective. So, you know, they'll be able to filter and translate player desires for their character design to like a visual language that an artist can actually make something tangible out of, right? And they're able to kind of juggle the language of all of these different disciplines and interface with us in the ways that we are most able to hear them. And it's very distinct from my responsibilities and my desires and duties as a game master, where I feel really grateful to have C in all of our corners, because they are, at the end of the day, in so many ways, an advocate for the story that we're all trying to tell. And as the GM, sometimes I can lose sight of that. Like, I can get a little too in the weeds and like building an encounter and kind of forget about like the greater thing we're trying to do here, right? Similar to how a player might get a little too in the weeds of their own specific like character and kind of forget about how that might affect like the greater dynamic at the table as a whole. So what C said earlier about how being a dramaturg isn't about pushing C's vision on everyone. Like, that's never been what it is. It's been about having a intimate and deep understanding of everyone's visions at the table and being able to make sure everyone is communicating with each other and choreographing with each other and improvising with each other in a way that resonates and is cohesive. And I think at least the way that we do dramaturgy, it takes a very specific and knowledgeable skill set to do. I don't think I could do C's job, to be quite frank. Like, I it would be really hard for me for various reasons. So I feel really lucky that C is here.
I want to ask Connie more on that. You mentioned in there like how it changes your role as a GM. I want to dig in on that a bit more, because like a lot of people listening are probably GMs, maybe for actual play, maybe for home games. I'm curious, what does it allow you to do more of, and what does it allow you to, you know, not have on your plate that makes you like a better GM in your vision?
It really allows me to kind of hit the ground running with my prep, because I already know what the players want and what I can plan towards. Because in my experience with, for instance, GMing a home game, or back when I was still GMing professional games, which I stopped because I hated doing it. I just burned out so quickly, is kind of the big bottleneck, like a choke point for me in my prep process, was talking to the players, to each of the players, and making sure that all of their interests were represented in the upcoming session and in the upcoming narrative. And that process just takes a lot of time, both for like practical reasons, like scheduling. Like, it can sometimes be hard to get a hold of a specific person, you know what I mean? Or like, it takes time to talk to someone and bounce ideas off of someone, and then like, you know, follow an idea to its terminus and then realize, oh, maybe that doesn't really work. Oh, or what if we coupled that idea with this idea back here? Or, oh, actually, as the GM, I know this thing's actually happening in the background, so why don't we bring out the secret third thing to make it actually resonate in this direction? All of that C's able to do. And do really well, because they have access to my entire trove and all of my secrets as the GM. They have complete access to everything I have as the GM. And they're able to do all of these meetings with all of that knowledge in place. So if they know that a character moment might be like compounded by like a secret thing I have planned, they can kind of speak toward it without ruining the surprise. All of that good stuff. So I can, like I said, I can really hit the ground running with my prep, with knowing exactly where the characters' headspaces are at, and then planning encounters that kind of exacerbate it, make it worse, make it even more dramatic and fictitious in a fun way. It's also like the biggest boon for having a dramaturg is kind of the biggest wish I hear from a lot of GMs, which is, oh, I wish I had someone to talk to about this. Like, I wish I had someone to tell my big villain twist to, but the people I would tell are in my campaign. Like, I can't tell my players. So C is that person. We have an entire channel in our production Discord called Schemes, where I will just, we will put evil ideas in there at each other.
Evil
and like
schemes.
ID on them. Evil, evil ideas. And we'll ideate on them. And that is like one of the biggest boons and bonuses of having a dramaturg.
Oh, I love that.
I distinctly remember the first time that Abby, my wife, was in a game that I was playing rather than just hearing about the game, and like finishing a session and going over to her and being like, "Ah, I can't tell you anything.
Yep.
you don't know what that spoon feeling. Means. You don't know."
It's so gratifying to have someone that I can tell the secrets of the spoon to. That was actually one of the big challenges for the second stranger, because she was a player in the second stranger. So they kind of took on a dramaturg role in the back half of the campaign because it was needed. I really needed help, I think, with like braiding the world together. But they could dramaturg everyone else, but they couldn't dramaturg themselves. That is, I think, one of the biggest things we've learned moving into Chaos. Is one of the questions I had was, do you want to play in this campaign, C? And at the end of the day, we decided, like, you know, we wanted C to be the dramaturg instead. They do occasionally play as an NPC. They like step in sometimes in front of the camera as an NPC that will recur and is quite an important NPC, actually. But we learned from the second stranger that for C to actually do their job fully, like, they can't both play and dramaturg. I think it's a really difficult ask, unless we had a second separate dramaturg dramaturging C, because I tried to dramaturg C for the second stranger, and that was kind of when I learned that I am not really great at the role.
There, it's a lot of different skill sets.
I'm curious, C, like, does that choice, how do you feel about that choice? Like, do you still, I imagine you would still feel like a player in some way. Like, how do you feel about that choice of like, if I'm to do my job, I can't get in front of the camera? Like, how does that feel for you as a choice?
I stand by that choice, and I'm really happy I made that choice, because I don't feel separate from Chaos. Even though I'm not a player and I'm not a GM, I can feel my presence in the way that folks are performing, and I can feel my story also is part of the story, right? In the way that I work with Connie as like kind of an assistant director slash like co-producer in like the very big overarching, like, why are we telling this story? What is this story? Is it about? What does it mean? And even in the day to day, like, it's a new level of engagement and excitement that I get, where like, I would have like a fantastic meeting with someone where they're like, oh, I know exactly how to approach this moment, and I want it to read like this, and I'm really invested in this. And to like sit back as the dramaturg and then watch them execute that moment more beautifully and more powerfully than we could have even imagined in that dramaturgy meeting, and knowing that it came from the fruit of that conversation that we made together, is like so exciting. And like so visceral in a way that makes me feel like I'm part of it still. And I think like all of the other things I do on the production end of like, I'm live mixing music for them that everyone can hear and everyone is listening to and that is coming out on stream. And I'm doing a million other tasks at the same time. And yes, I do occasionally come on as an NPC, which I think fills that kind of performance desire that I have. But taking it from the approach of an NPC is actually really fun and like really narratively interesting, challenging in its own way, but in a way that I find very fruitful, where I get to kind of have the best of both worlds as a producer, a dramaturg, a co-GM in some strange, weird moments. But also, like Connie said, you can't do the role of a dramaturg. I cannot do the role of a GM. It does not spark joy. It does not spark joy for me,
yeah.
But I get to kind of have the best of both worlds in this role, I think. And I really stand by that decision. And I'm glad that I didn't try to be a player as well, because I think I would not be able to fulfill the role of a player in a narratively satisfying way for myself in a craft perspective or from a story perspective. I wouldn't be able to do either. I wouldn't be as good at dramaturging as I am, and I wouldn't be as good as performing as I am right now. And I think that kind of is where I've landed on going into Chaos, and I'm really happy with my role right now. It's really satisfying in a way that I think is very singular to this table.
Pocket Bard is a free audio app that helps game masters weave immersive sound into their games. Pocket Bard's design is intuitive and simple to use, but I don't want to just say that. I want to prove it to you here and now. So the rest of this ad you're going to hear is going to be live and uncut while I am actively using the Pocket Bard app. So to start, let's set the scene. Imagine your party has entered a new location, a small town. With just one click, we hear that ambience coming in, but maybe I want to augment the sound of that town a little bit. Maybe the crowd is a bit bigger than what we're hearing here. With just one click, I can add more crowd in. Maybe all of a sudden the skies begin to slightly darken and a rain begins. We can hear that rain start over here. Maybe that rain gets a little bit heavier. Maybe the skies darken even more and we hear thunder and wind whipping around behind us. And all of a sudden, the air drops, the temperature drops, everything feels a little bit more intense as all of a sudden you get to say those three magic words as a game master: roll for initiative. And with just one click, that combat music comes in. We can increase or decrease the intensity with the intensity slider. And there are even one-shot sounds that you can use, like the town bell tolling in the background, letting the town know they are under attack. Maybe your ranger is drawing their bow and firing an arrow. And maybe your spellcasters are slinging spells left and right. The whole time you are doing this with just little clicks on your phone, it is incredibly easy to use and very intuitive. It's something I could actually use in my home game to make my sessions more immersive and exciting. So if you want to learn more about Pocket Bard, you can search for it in the App Store or by visiting pocketbard.app.
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go, see for yourself, 3 floors up, gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amaretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
So I love talking about elements of process, especially for actual play. And there's a thing that as we've been talking about dramaturgy throughout this conversation, that the way that you guys make Transplaner requires more, I don't want to say buy-in, but commitment from your players in terms of just like sheer time, sheer ability to agree upon the same like shared vision. And especially with having those pillars of grief, vengeance, and revolution from the outset, I'm curious how you all approached casting for this show and how you look at performance and like what to you, what in your mind makes a performer especially equipped for the type of stories that you want to tell?
For us, in terms of the casting process, we don't really do open casting calls for like several reasons. One of them is because of like the very specific kinds of themes we're playing toward. So it tends to be, you know, for safety reasons too. Like, we tend to like pick from a pool of people we've interacted with already in some type of way whose artistic process we're already kind of familiar with. So we had for Chaos a kind of pool of people that we were looking at for the show. And ultimately it boiled down to chemistry between the players as well. That was really important to us. So we did a couple of like home games. We invited some of the people in that pool, and we let them know very transparently that, like, hey, this is like a little Connie Run, like 2-3 shot, but also we're like using this as a way to kind of like cast for our next show. And even if like we don't ask you to be a main player, like we definitely still want to keep working with you like in the future and have you on for other things. So that was kind of how we found Kai, Val, and Sam. I ran the like 2 miniseries home games. They were not recorded with this pool of essentially like cast candidates. And then C and I had like meetings about it. Like a C sat in and like observed all of the sessions as well. And we discussed kind of like potential places of like chemistry that we were sensing. We discussed like the decisions that these players made like in character and why they made those decisions. Just things we noticed, very positive things we noticed about all of the performers. And ultimately it came down to like choosing, we knew we wanted there to be 3. We wanted this to be a 3 player table. So we knew we could only cast 3 people. So we were thinking of like, okay, in a 3-person dynamic, then that's a trio, right? How are they as a solo performer? How are they in a scene with 1 other person? And how are they with like sharing a table with like 2 other people? And also like their overall affect when it comes to performing. Like we wanted something that would jive with each other. For instance, this is so funny. I was watching a Netflix show where it's called Building the Band. I don't know if
you've heard of it, but it's,
yeah, basically they're trying to cast like the next like singer group, like girl group, boy group, or like mixed group or whatever. I don't know why it's so gendered, but something that a lot of the candidates, I guess is what they're called, the contestants on that show, they're all singers. They're all very talented vocalists. Something that a lot of them kept saying in their talking head scenes when they were listening to the performances of other contestants and trying to build their band together was, oh, I really like her tone, but I don't know if I'd blend well with her. And that was something that I resonated with, actually, because there are so many strong performers in the space, but it's about who would blend well with each other at the table and also blend well with this story. So for us, in terms of specific things I like to look for as a GM is the kind of energy they bring to the table. So are they a very high energy performer? Are they a bit more low key? How do they actually perform? Do they gesticulate a lot? Are they able to have a kind of captivating performance? That was important to me. Like, are they able to capture attention? The second thing was, are they able to think about their character in a deep, rich, and nuanced way? So like, are they able to like embody their character and have like layers to it, right? Like embody their character with layers, but also be flexible with their embodiment of the character. Like if I threw something at them as the GM and I'm clearly inviting them to step into a moment of fear or a moment of rage, do they take it or do they resist it, right? Either choice is okay. It's the reason behind the choice, I think, that is most important. Like, are they resisting it because they're like, no, I don't think my character would do that. Or are they resisting it because they're like, I actually think it would make a more interesting story moment if I resisted this invitation, right? So kind of a core principle for us is strong ideas loosely held. Are they able to do that and bring that to the table? And that I hold that principle for myself as well.
I also want to say and iterate that basically everyone we reached out to for the chaos casting process, like, would have made an excellent chaos cast member. And it really just, it's the hard actual play casting thing of like, okay, there are only 3 main players. Cause it really did just kind of boil down to some level of instinct, I think, too, of who do we really think would be able to do these like solo, duet, and trio work and aligned very well with the themes and the desires that we were already percolating on for chaos. And then to say like, well, I hope we get to play with everyone that we reached out to in many iterations and many different like directions and desires too.
I do want to jump in just to say that I feel like when you say it was just instinct, it feels almost a little bit too casual because that was hard won instinct by doing 4 to 6 sessions unrecorded just to test who would be good together. Like, yes, it's kind of that thing of like, it's easier to get lucky if you're throwing a lot of darts at the dartboard. Putting in that amount of time is something that most 99% of actual players are not doing. And so only have that one throw at a dartboard to find that chemistry. Whereas you guys are doing significant amount of research to try to find that.
That's a really good point, actually. I agree with that a lot too, because our pre-production process is hefty. Not just for starting the campaign, but for each arc leading up, like the start of each arc. So we just came off of like a 5-month hiatus. And I we'll say clearly, we have been working on Arc 4 for that entire 5-month hiatus. We were working on Chaos pre-production for like 9 months, leading up to actually like bringing people in.
Like launching the show. Yeah.
Launching the show. And we had people working on like the pre-production for their characters for months. And we had like many multiple session zeros, very in-depth session zeros, where part of the casting process also included being like, hey, folks that we're interested in working with, here are the things that we're getting into with this story. They are not light. Like you mentioned earlier, like this is a lot of work. Here is how you will be paid for that work. And I think just kind of like a sidebar is that we pay weekly instead of episode based. So we pay based on the work that you do that week. It's kind of how we frame instead of just showing up for the episode, because I think that better identifies how much work, intention, and desire and thought goes into an episode of Chaos. It's not just sitting down for the 3 hours of recording. It is also the like the dramaturgy meetings and the thinking about your characters for so that you have stuff to talk about during dramaturgy and what you do after the dramaturgy meeting to prepare yourself and so on and so forth. But that's kind of an aside.
No, it's a very good aside.
But we came to the players with like basically all of that and be like, hey, this is a story about grief where you are going to experience meaningful grief. And we are going to dig into that with really kind of sharp teeth. It's going to ask a lot of you in a lot of ways. Are you open to that? Are you interested in that? Is that something that you want? If you don't, that's totally okay. And we'd love to have you as a guest spot or in a different show like that doesn't explore these kind of themes. But here's where we're going. Here's how hard we want to go. Are you down for that? And ultimately, the Chaos cast was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, yeah, all of them 10 toes down.
This.
They were like, hurt right. us, hurt us, please. We want this, right?
Yeah, we're and in that, for eight that, arcs.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. 8 arcs, years. We also told them like the time commitment too. We were like, hey, straight up, Stranger took like 3 years. This is probably going to take like 2.5, 3 years too. They're all like, okay, sure. We can stream weekly for 3 years. We are able to do that. So very transparent from the beginning about the commitment, the payment process, the intensity of it too. And I think, see, like what you mentioned about how transparent we are about the themes is it's an important part of our safety process, too, where we're really clear to the players about how intense, how involved, and how serious the show is going to be from the very beginning. So we don't run into a situation where, like, we're a week out from premiering and a player is like, actually, like, one of my, like, lines is death of loved
death
ones.
Death of loved ones.
We'd be like, oh, no. That's what the show is about, right? Yeah.
I was going to mention safety because it feels like this whole process of having a dramaturg creates an atmosphere that is a safety tool in and of itself, of like there's a lot of communication about everything. There's a lot of like listening to everyone about like what their concerns are, goals, hopes. Like it feels like safety is just at the core of this and like creates such a safe environment that then you can, you know, we recently talked to Avery Alder and Avery Alder said safety tools are for sickos. Like we have safety tools because we want to explore the dark shit. And I feel like that's so apparent like with what y'all do that like you have this really strong pre-production process. 5 months, crazy. My producer brain like exploded when you said that, which is awesome. But like, it's like it, you do that so that you can get like all the way in the muck on it, and that's really. And I want to underline another thing you said in there. You pay people weekly. You pay people for the time outside of just recording, and I think it's because of all this that you have people who are willing to commit to 8 arcs. So I want to underline that for people that like pay people for the work they do. That rocks. Yeah. We love that. We always want to shout out paying people for the work they do. I didn't have a question. I was just shouting it out.
No, you're right and you should say it.
This does just make me really, for the past like year and a half, 2 years, we've been talking about wanting to do longer form projects because all of our stuff is shorter form. And by virtue of that, we don't go in depth as much as you guys as Transplaner does, because we're trying to do like let's show off the game on My First Dungeon, so it's a little more surface level look at what actual play is. We still go deep into it as we can, but without a significantly larger framework and like structure behind it, there's only so deep you can go. And like talking about all of this pre-production process and the depth and the breadth that you get that Transplaner goes into. Really makes me want to dive into a bigger thing that we've been talking about for the past 2 years that who knows if we'll ever actually do.
Yes.
You should do it.
it.
Do it. Do it.
Whenever we find that 26th and 27th hour in the day.
right. It's somewhere around here. I guess on that front, like, because we're kind of in this position, what would y'all tell shows that want to incorporate this kind of infrastructure into their actual play? Of like, it's like, I'll speak as me. I would love to do something like dramaturgy for our shows. I feel unqualified, maybe, or like I don't know where to start with it. Like, where do you start if you wanted to, like, if you were giving advice to someone with an AP that wanted to bring in a dramaturgical process?
I am so ready for this. First, I was not qualified when I started on the role of dramaturg for Transplaner at all. I just had a strong feeling and I had a strong desire and I just tried. I experimented, and the type of dramaturgy that I did at the beginning is definitely not the type of dramaturgy I'm doing now. And just like how I would ask, and we ask any performer to come not at 100% every week, because that's not feasible. You can't do that. But to bring the best self that you have today to the table. That's also how I approach my dramaturgy work. I may not know everything about the history of theater, but I do not need to. I only need to bring my most dedicated self every day to the table and to try hard for my production. And I think ultimately, like, a lot of what my process boils down to is just I care so much that it is no longer physically capable for me to not do it, right? No matter what kind of art form we were making, even if I never touched actual play again, I would need to make art. I would need to tell stories. And this is just my expression of that need of caring deeply. And I think there is sometimes hesitation, especially at a new table, where you're like, I know this is true for me as a player, where I'm like, I'm not sure how hard I can go. I'm not sure how hard I can care if I'm invited to care this hard, if other people are invested or interested the way I am. And I always find it very fruitful, especially if I'm leading or co-leading a production, to step in and to say, I care. I'm deeply invested. Here's what that care looks like. Here's what that investment looks like. It's never going to be perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. But I am going to try and I am going to care very deeply about this. And this is the way that that's going to manifest. And stepping in with that kind of intention instead of weighing yourself against some level of experience or expertise that I think is also unachievable, like, I also don't have that, right? And I'm not necessarily striving toward that. All I want is to strengthen and enliven the story that I'm telling with my friends that I very deeply care about. And I care about my ensemble. I care about ensemble work. I care about art. And I want to keep improving that art and keep improving that craft. And my own craft as a dramaturg, I want to keep improving. I want to keep finessing how I give notes. I want to keep being able to have interesting conversations and resonate in ways that I couldn't before, be able to pick up audience experiences and go, okay, no, I do know that. And it just comes with time and experience. And I think communication is key, right? Being able to take that first step and to be like, okay, here's how I'm going to care. And here's what it looks like. Here's what I want. Do you all want this? Could you want this with the right support? If you don't, that is totally cool. But when you do, I think that's where the magic happens, when everyone is on the same page of like, yeah, you're supposed to care a lot. Yeah, you're supposed to put in some hours here. That's what we're all doing. That's what we want. And I think a lot more people in the actual play space, especially on the narrative side of things, really want that. And to develop that table culture, that trust, that communication to go there, I think is the natural first step. And everything else kind of falls in line with practice after that.
From my perspective as a GM working with a dramaturg, I would say if you're interested and you're either you want to be the dramaturg, which I can speak to less, or you're interested in bringing on a dramaturg and you're the showrunner or the GM or even a producer, I would say things to look for and things to think about in that process are, because dramaturg is such a flexible role, A dramaturg, I know, for instance, D20 has like a lore keeper, and so does CR, but they don't, as far as I know, they don't do dramaturgy the same way that we do. They just kind of keep track of what the GM says and make sure that canon is adhered to, right? So they don't like say a name that is actually not true, something like that. So is that what you're looking for in a dramaturg? Are you looking for someone to help you keep your notes straight? Because that is one role that a dramaturg can take, and they can let you know, like, hey, Connie, you said this date, but it was actually this date. Like, that can be helpful. Or are you looking for someone to help you essentially like co-create the world with you and also act as a liaison to the players and help them facilitate their character arcs in a way that is resonant with the greater GM story, which is always, for me, tied with the PC's stories? That is kind of more C's role. And if that's the case, then kind of what I look for in a dramaturg and what C excellently does is someone who is able to understand what we're trying to do with the campaign and in every part of their work advocate for that vision, because advocating for that vision ultimately also advocates for me as the GM and advocates for the players. So this tends to be someone, you don't need to have like a 1,000 years of history knowledge about the history of theater. Like, you don't have to know all the names and the dates of things in film and TV and all that stuff. More so is someone who's good at critical thinking. Has like a good critical analysis brain.
Media analysis.
Yes. If you have a friend who you love talking about film with, who like has interesting things to say about films or books, they're usually probably already positioned to be a really good dramaturg because they're able to see like the themes and motifs of a piece of media and analyze it. And I think that is a skill set that every like good dramaturg that I like to work with has. Also someone who because being a dramaturg, and this is like an undersung part of the skill set, is I think you have to be kind of a good people person. C is really good at managing people because they manage both like my both the happy sides of being a people person, the excitement, the thrill of it all, but they also manage like the more challenging aspects of it too. For instance, if we come off of a stream and someone is like, I hated my performance, you know, and they feel really bad. And this happens to me not infrequently, you know, like they feel, you know, weird or bad. There's bleed, you know, it's a lot of the times this then comes out in our subsequent dramaturgy meetings, and C is there to make sure that players feel taken care of, that I feel taken care of as a GM, that we are able to still be like aligned with the story that we're telling, even if we do face challenges. And of course, to be able to manage differing opinions. So sometimes C will like carry an idea that I have as a GM, or like they know that there's something that we're trying to accomplish as like the GM here. And then a player will say something that's like, maybe like not super aligned with what the story needs. So C is then going to have to step into a position where they essentially communicate to the player, I love that idea. Here's why I think like the idea that you have for how to execute it might not make the most sense in this current iteration, but here are some ideas I have for how you could execute it that does make sense, right? And knowing how to say that in a way that can be heard and in a way that is respectful, of course, and prioritizes the player's desires. So I think those two skills are honestly more important than like knowing stuff and like having a lot of like formal training, I think.
And Elliot, from the, you know, by having the way that we make My First Dungeon, by having a producer on the outside, like I'm thinking back to our season of Die, that having you on a Discord chat that was like open in a corner and knowing that there was someone enthusiastically watching and exciting about what was happening was great. Like, you were able to give me like the technical things that I needed to know, like reminders about rules, reminders about time, all the stuff that just makes my physical job a little bit easier. But then also, like, when I'm trying to lay the track in front of me as fast as I can, trying to keep up with five players who are all doing very interesting things, all of the best moments that anyone ever comments on in that season were you being able to stand kind of 10 feet back and be like, hey, Brian, if you look up for 1 second, you can, from what you're doing, you can see the bigger picture. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, great. I can now cherry pick directly from this other person's brain and take this great idea that is...
Elliot, you are already dramaturging.
What? Yeah, I know, right? You're doing it already.
I told you, Brian, you did it already.
What you said actually made me think, reminded me of actually one of... A little embarrassing, but one of the biggest and most consistent notes C has given me as a GM, and this is true, like they give the same note like arc after arc because it's a thing I constantly need to work on as GM, is like, be present in the scene. Because I feel like as a GM, we're constantly juggling 1,000 things at once. That sometimes, like, I'll be like, okay, I'm setting up this encounter. Like, the players are doing something really interesting. Like, for instance, Zynan could be having, like, a really interesting character moment. And I'm technically playing an NPC in the scene, but I'm, like, preparing for what's about to come next. Or I'm, like, checking my notes. And I'll be like, okay. And the NPC says, yeah, sure, boss. But yeah, okay, da-da-da-da. And, like, doesn't actually respond or engage with the heart of the scene or what, like, the player is trying to do in the moment. So to no fault of the GMs, because as a GM, we are doing a lot of things all the time.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yes, a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff. So the dramaturg, I think, C, really helps remind me of, like, hey, actually, all that stuff you're doing is important, sure, but when you're actually running the game, make sure that you're actually in it with your players, because that'll actually help me respond and engage in ways that feel more, like, emotionally resonant, both as an NPC and in how I describe the setting and how I adjudicate outcomes, right? So that is another thing I'm really grateful to see for. And I think that's one of my dead angles as a GM that I've become aware of because of C.
Oh, love that. I love when we talk to creative partnerships, because it always makes us see something in, like, our own creative partnership. It's just really fun. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So when we brought you on, we intended to talk for at least half of the podcast about Arc 4 of Chaos Protocol, but we found ourselves an hour in and rapidly running out of time. We've barely touched on it. So we need to dig into what Arc 4 is going to look like now that that is premiering. So can you give us, like, a small preview on what people can expect in Arc 4? And also, I know you guys are playing with a new game system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So for Arc 4, this is our first of three planned PC spotlight arcs. So our first three arcs have been, like, general kind of arcs, right, that all players are involved with, of course. And Arc 4 focuses on one player character's backstory. We're actually going back to this character's backstory plane of existence that he thought was dead. Like, he didn't know this plane of existence was still in existence. So that's, like, a big revelation that kind of happens toward the end of Arc 3. So Arc 4 is essentially a post-apocalyptic survival arc. And the PCs have crash landed on this planet. It used to be a beautiful green place, like very neon solar punk, right? Like a beautiful, like full of life and brimming with biodiversity. But there has been a climate apocalypse called the dust, also known as the drought or the wasting, essentially sucked all the moisture out of the planet. And now this planet is desiccated. It is gray. It is dying. And it's about to completely go kaput unless the players do something about it. So that's kind of the premise of Arc 4. They've crash landed on Kaseki and now they have to kind of figure their shit out. They both have to survive the horrors of this post-apocalyptic landscape, which is kind of like if Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, we fast forwarded like 10,000 years into the future and something terrible happened, plus like Mad Max Fury Road. It's like those two things colliding with each other. And to that end, we're playing 12-sided studios, Force of Extinction, which as of this recording is currently still being playtested before the full game is released. And we're happily one of like the big kind of visible playtesting APs doing this system. It's basically a survival game about mutation and resource management. So they have a really cool D20 pool system, but it's a roll under. So you roll like a bunch of D20s and you're looking for a number to match or go under like a threshold. And it's a lot of fun because nat 20s are bad here. You don't want a nat 20. You're looking for the nat ones, right? And it's dangerous. There's a lot of like fun stuff about evolution, a lot of fun stuff about the questions of the demands of survival and how far you would go to ensure your own survival and the survival of the people you love and care about. And if there are any lines you would not cross, if any, in service of that. And also questions about home, right? Because this is a homecoming for one of our PCs. Like C mentioned way earlier in the chat, it's about coming back to a home that you thought was gone. And now that you're back, it has changed like irrevocably in ways that you could have never imagined in your worst nightmares. And how does that square up with your own vision of home? What does home mean? And what would you do to protect your home or to keep your home safe? So those are like the core arc themes we're kind of grappling with alongside the overarching campaign themes that are going to be really apparent here of grief and vengeance and revolution. Because to not spoil anything, you know, there are analogs to real world climate change happening right now and how climate change is being exacerbated and accelerated by capitalism, right? Overproduction, deforestation, pollution, all these things generating terrible climate apocalypses and climate disasters that disproportionately affect indigenous and black and brown folk in the global south. That is very much something we're resonating with when looking at this arc.
I mean, as at time of recording, there's a horrific hurricane blowing through Jamaica right now. See, could you talk more about that, about kind of how you're helping weave these themes into this new arc and like amidst that context of thinking about the real world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just because you brought it up just now, something that we talked about in our pre-production process, and I think spending a full hour talking about that actually frames how we talk and think about ARC4 very well, because it all feeds into each other. But part of kind of the meta-textual and above the table intention that we're setting for this arc is that we're doing a lot of charity fundraising. So at least half of the episodes, if not all of them, will very likely be fundraising for relief efforts. So this coming Saturday as of recording, so the second stream of ARC4 is going to be raising funds for Jamaican hurricane relief. It's kind of like the meta, what we as people are doing, not just as storytellers, but as storytellers, we are also grappling with these questions of wealth inequality, environmental catastrophe, home loss, grief. And something that we do for each of our arcs is not just to have our three themes and thesis statements for the overall campaign, but we also make two additional sub-themes and sub-thesis statements for each arc in our pre-production process. So alongside grief, revolution, and vengeance as our main campaign themes, we are also bringing in themes and thesis statements about survival and about home, like Connie mentioned. So we have strong desires about what we want to say about this, what we want to say about the ways in which we have lost home and ways to talk about that in terms of resonating on wavelengths of diaspora and homelessness in some instances, poverty, that we as an ensemble, but also as individuals have experienced and are bringing into the story in ways that have been funneled through, I think, metaphor and through story, where we get to very deeply and thoughtfully think about the ways in which we are in conflict. And Connie can speak to this more, but I'll also kind of prime this conversation when we think of ourselves as non-colonial storytellers existing in a non-colonial world, an anti-Orientalist world. It is actually really, really important to us, and something that I think is sometimes misunderstood by wider audiences. That doesn't mean that we are telling stories devoid of conflict, right? We are imagining conflict beyond a colonial lens, right? And it is actually really important to do, because I hope when we live in a world where there isn't any fucking colonialism and there isn't imperialism and there isn't Orientalism, we will still be in conflict with each other. That is actually a really important part of living, that there will be conflict, and being able to understand, think about, and process conflict, grief, loss, revolution, vengeance, violence through a non-colonial lens is really important to me, in being able to imagine the realistic and beautiful and desired world that I want to see, because I don't want to live in a world without conflict. I want to live in a world where I can meaningfully make change in response to conflict that exists. I'm never going to live in a world that is devoid of loss of loved ones. Everyone dies. It happens, right? People that I love will die. I will die, right? I will suffer. But I hope to not suffer under colonialism, capitalism, hegemony, oppression, right? But I also need to be able to process conflict that I will have interpersonally, conflict on a power difference scale, and conflict that I will have with the natural forces of the world. So this arc kind of starts to entangle itself and really kind of paint a deeper level of conflict. And I think processing that conflict in ways that are not easy to swallow, is the PCs are in this place that, yeah, there has been a really vicious, really hard to deal with apocalypse here. And it's not just an apocalypse for an apocalypse's sake, right? This happened for a reason. It was caused by many, many different layers, and there's no easy one thing to say, like, oh, it's just the big evil bad guy, the allegory for capitalism. It's like, this is complicated in a way that I think we'll have to untangle in really complex ways.
I think for us, I mean, C really hit the nail on the head, just because we're facilitating and playing in a world that is non-colonial and devoid of things like white supremacy, right, of racism, of transphobia, of sexism. It doesn't mean that there's no drama. I mean, you tune into any episode of Transplaner and like shit's happening, like shit's hitting the fan. Like there's drama, there's conflict, there's heartache. There are knives being flung around. So like that in and of itself is I think a testament to how dramatic and intense our show can get. But it's a really interesting and fun challenge for me as the GM to build, because my job as the game master is to build the antagonists, right? Because like there's no fun if there's no obstacles. From a narrative level, conflict is what makes story interesting, at least the stories that I like to tell in AP. So I feel like in a colonial context, it can be quite easy to build antagonists because I'll be like, okay, I'm just going to build like a war criminal, right? And it can be easy to be like, let's get rid of this war criminal because they're committing war crimes, obviously, right? Or like, I'm going to build someone who is a fascist. Or like, this antagonist is going to be like a horrible sexist man, right? Or like, this antagonist is going to be racist and we're going to kill this racist, which is great and fun and can be really cathartic and meaningful, but it's also easy. You know, I think it's a really easy way to build an antagonist. And a lot of the times, because we feel like we've given these antagonists kind of bigoted traits, traits that we see reflected in people we dislike in the real world, then we don't have to make them complex. And in fact, I would have questions about how and why we would want to complexify, for instance, a sexist Nazi in our show. So
I think it's unethical.
I think it's unethical. Yeah. I think it's unethical to portray like a Nazi in a complex way, because then even if you're trying to question it or interrogate it, you're still humanizing them in some way, right? Which can maybe be the point, like Nazis were humans and they were able to do these terrible things. But I'm like, okay, what purpose is that serving? Like nowadays, I feel like we just have to punch.
And we kind of done that.
Yeah, we've done that already. Yeah, and there are still Nazis. So I'm someone who really likes complex antagonists. I really love a quote unquote bad guy. That's like, you like look at them and you're like, man, you kind of have a point though. You know, you look at them and you're like, wow, like I can really understand why and how you chose this path. Like I might have even chosen that path if I were suffering under the same context that you were, something like that. And antagonists that follow an internal logic that you can understand, you might even be able to empathize with, you might even in some respects agree with if things were different. And in order to do that, I think having a non-colonial world actually helps a lot, because then my antagonists aren't metaphors for bigotry. They're not stand-ins for fascists. They're not stand-ins for war criminals or anything. They're just people who have done some questionable or hurtful things, but for perhaps good reasons, or at the very least, understandable reasons. And moving into Arc 4, that's very much going to be the case as well. Actually, what's really interesting is one of the conversations we had from one of our many session zeros leading into Arc 4 was we straight up told our players, hey, so on our campaign-wide lines is stuff like racism, sexism, colonialism, slavery, et cetera, but what's specifically not on our lines is classism and capitalism. We've always been okay with exploring questions of wealth inequality, interestingly, like divorced from structures of white supremacy, right? So one of the questions I asked the players was, hey, so Arc 4 is very plainly going to grapple with questions of wealth inequality. And in terms of like the quote unquote, the main antagonists of this arc, they're essentially kind of like space trillionaires, right? They're like space trillionaires, right? They're sci-fi trillionaires. So my question to the players was like, how nuanced do you want them to be? Because I would be happy to actually make them just like, hey, they're trillionaires, and because of that, they're fundamentally evil. You don't have to feel bad about killing them at all. Or do you actually want there to be a bit more nuance, a bit more layer, a bit more complexity? And my players really thought about it, right? They really like sat there and they like had a good think about it. And they all, pretty much all of them came back to us and they were like, we actually want there to be some nuance here. Like we understand that the structures that enable the existence of a trillionaire are fundamentally evil, right? Because that it fundamentally relies on exploitation and wealth inequality and all extractionism, right? But in terms of like the arc-wide antagonists, they were like, we actually want to be able to to interact with them in more complex and interesting ways, like ways that might even resonate with our character arcs, right? Right? Like if a bad guy isn't just like an evil trillionaire, could they resonate with our own character arcs of having to do really bad things because there are no good choices in a world where you have to survive? Having to make decisions that will inevitably doom someone else, but if you don't, then you yourself might be doomed. And how could we also maybe see parts of ourselves reflected in these antagonists? So without spoiling anything, an antagonist I really enjoy that I think is able to toe this line a lot in other media is Lady Eboshi from Princess Mononoke, where she's doing the deforestation, right? She's like doing some questionable shit, but you also kind of get it, right? But the narrative does neither absolves her nor condemns her, but just makes her a person put in a bad position trying to do things for good ideals. And that's interesting to me.
Now that's proper Ghibli-esque.
Oh, yeah.
to use the term properly. Well, it's very exciting headed into Arc 4. Wishing you guys the best of luck, like, going into it. I love that, you know, I feel like the multiversal, multi-system campaign is one of those things that's been talked about in TTRPGs over the years, but y'all are doing it, and that's great to see. I'm sure we could keep talking. I want to get you guys out of here. So we're going to go into our final question that we ask everybody who comes on the show, and that is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking y'all for a recommendation of anything for our audience. It can be a person, a place, a resource. It can be in tabletop, outside of tabletop. It could be to go for a walk. You can recommend whatever you'd like to our audience.
My recommendation is Godkiller Kismat, which is a multilingual actual play created by Aman and currently streaming through Pantsless Tables. Like I mentioned, it is a multilingual actual play where multiple sets of gods and god killers set on different planets in a particular multiverse are telling an overarching narrative using the god killer system. And this is one of my favorite uses of, I love all of the god killer shows that come out. It really like makes my heart sing because god killer is such an important game to me. But I really, really think that what Aman is doing with this project in particular is really, really special and a really beautiful breath of fresh air, and pushing actual play in a really interesting direction. And I think all of the episodes are just absolutely striking and moving and beautifully, like visually beautiful and narratively beautiful as well. So I'm going to bring Godkiller Kismat to the table. And I'm also going to say everyone should ride a horse at least once in their life.
Yeah. That's so you.
Hell yeah.
That's I'm having so a you. Horse girl revival. My inner 14-year-old is thriving.
Yeah, you're getting back into equestrining?
No.
Equestrian?
No.
Oh, no.
Just straight
being
up
an
no.
Equestrian. Yeah. I'm the assistant to the groom. I drive them. And I help the groom the horse. What I'm bringing to the table are two essays/works that I recommend people read. One of them is Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination by Toni Morrison. It is a crucial work when it comes to, if you want to think about critical thinking and looking at media in interesting ways, I highly recommend reading this book. It talks about how whiteness is a point of view that is often invisibilized and cannot disentangle itself from blackness, by Toni Morrison. And I highly, highly recommend you read it. She like really critiques and interrogates authors like Ernest Hemingway and stuff. And it's really, really interesting. Another work I highly recommend people read is Ways of Seeing by John Berger. I believe it first aired as a television program, but has since been consolidated into like a series of essays that are now in a book. I read this in college and it really helped shape the way that I look at art and just look at the world and how the ways we see the world, the ways we look at media is political and is biased. And as soon as we realize that, we're able to look at things in a more complex and interesting way. I would say these two works are pretty foundational to my understanding of non-colonial world building too. I would start there if I were you, and you were interested in that as well.
We will put all of those links in the show notes below, as well as links to Transplanar and where you can find Connie and C online if you're looking for them. Thank you both so much for coming on Talk to the Table. It was absolutely great having you. We have won way over time, and I'm sure we'll have you back to go over time
yet again. Thank you both so much.
Yay!
And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the Many Sided newsletter or talk about this episode over on the Many Sided Media Discord. Both those links are in the show notes below. As always, rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.